The hospital's lobby was marked in bright red.
"Did you turn that on?"
Angelique asked, her voice slightly breathless. Stoner nodded. "This way," he said, taking her gently by the elbow. There were security checkpoints spaced along the corridor at every few cross hallways, a small desk with a uniformed guard sitting behind it, either looking bored or chatting with one of the hospital personnel. "Are you there?" called the guard at the first checkpoint they came to. "Where's your badge? And I need to see authorization papers for both of you." Before the young man was halfway out of his chair, Stoner went to the desk and said softly, "We're here by mistake. We're leaving now, so please don't make a fuss." The guard frowned at them as he stood up. He was a lanky youngster, a few centimeters taller than Stoner. "It's all right," Stoner said. "I assure you." The guard looked down at his desktop screen. It broke into electronic hash. "Dandrification," he muttered. "The computer's crashed again." "Does that happen often?" Stoner asked solicitously. "Now and then," the guard said, sinking back into his chair again. "It'll clear up in a few moments," said Stoner. "I guess." Stoner took Angelique's arm again, and they headed past the checkpoint and the addled security guard. Angelique stared up at Stoner in wonder. They passed four security checkpoints in much the same way as they threaded through the hospital's busy maze of corridors. At the fifth one, Stoner noticed a patient in a power chair trundling along behind them. He slowed their pace to let the chair pass them. A very old woman sat in it, little more than wrinkled skin and brittle bones, her wispy, dead-white hair floating like a halo. Instead of passing them, she stopped the chair.
"Where are you heading?" she asked.
Her voice was a brittle rasp. It reminded Angelique of a kitchen blender crushing ice cubes. "We're leaving," Stoner said, and he resumed walking along the corridor. Angelique started off beside him, and the old woman nudged the power chair's control stud to keep up with them. Angelique saw that she clutched an oversized paper book to her emaciated bosom.
"Take me with you,"
she begged in a scratchy whisper. Before Angelique could reply, the woman went on,
"I want to get out of here, too. They just stuck me in here to die. I want to get out."
Stoner looked down at her sternly.
"We can't," Angelique began to say. "We're only—"
But then Stoner's expression eased. Smiling, he said, "Come with us, then. But don't say a word to anyone. Let me do the talking." Chapter 4.
"He just walked out of the hospital with her?"
Archbishop Overmeyer felt more astonished than angry. His security chief stood uneasily before the archbishop's broad desk.
"Apparently so, Your Eminence.
He took the sister Angelique and walked past every checkpoint in the hospital. The guards in the front lobby say they think the two of them got into a taxi with another patient in a wheelchair. We're looking into the cab company's files."
"Another patient?" Overmeyer demanded. "Who?"
The security chief pulled a phone from the breast pocket of his uniform and worked its keyboard with a thumb.
"Her name is Yolanda Vasquez. Terminal patient. Age 107.
107?
What's her relationship to Sister Angelique? Or Stoner? Where does she fit into this?"
Licking his lips, the security chief said,
"We're looking into it, Your Eminence."
Overmeyer felt his face tighten into a frown.
"But how did he get into the interrogation room in the first place?"
The security chief waved one hand weakly.
"According to the three staff women, he just appeared, like he popped out of thin air." "And Dr. Mayfair? What does he say about this?"
"Nothing, sir. He seems to be in some sort of a coma. The medics said he's catatonic." The archbishop thought about that for a moment while the security chief fidgeted and shifted from one foot to the other. Despite his military-like tan uniform with its epaulettes and badges of rank, the man looked like a nervous little student brought to face the school's principal.
"Sit down, man, sit down."
"Thank you, sir." Overmeyer steepled his fingers and touched them to his fleshy lips. At last he said,
"So he simply appeared in the room out of nowhere, did he?"
"Yes, sir. According to the reports, Dr. Mayfair was in no condition to talk intelligibly, but the three women all confirmed that he
He just was there all of a sudden. I understand. He's done the same thing elsewhere. It's kind of spooky, said the security chief. But Overmeyer was musing. He came in that way, but he walked out like a normal, ordinary person. Right past Lord knows how many of my guards, the security chief muttered. He just walked right past them, and they let him do it. He had the woman with him at that point. Sister Angelique Dupree, yes, sir. And somewhere along the line he picked up this old lady Vasquez. What do we know about her? Working his pocket phone's keyboard again, the security chief replied. A retired schoolteacher. No criminal record, no security file. She seems to have been a model citizen all her life. Until she met Stoner, the archbishop mused. Then she escapes from the hospital with him. Yes, sir. And Sister Angelique. The archbishop smiled inwardly. To his security chief, he said, He appeared magically, but he walked out with the two women through the whole hospital building and left in a taxi. What does that tell you? The security chief's face furrowed with concentration. Before he could come up with a reply, the archbishop said triumphantly, He can pop in and out like a genie from the Arabian Nights, but he can't take someone else with him. The chief blinked several times, digesting the idea. Do you see what that means? Overmeyer crowed. It's a weakness, a chink in his armor. He can travel instantly wherever he wants to go, but he can't bring one of us along with him. He has to move normally when he's taking an ordinary person along with him. But he can talk his way past my guards, make them let him go right past them, somehow. Yes, yes. But as long as he's with one of us, he has to move like an ordinary human being. No instantaneous travel. I suppose so. The security chief sounded unconvinced. Speaking to his phone, the archbishop said, Get me the head of the National Science Foundation. I want him here in my office as quickly as he can get here. This is an emergency.
Bertram Feingold was philosophic about life. When they hand you a lemon, he always said, make lemonade. In a nation that revered prayer much more than research, a nation that banned much of biotechnology and all of nanotechnology, Feingold had made his slow, patient way to the top of the National Science Foundation by dint of avoiding conflicts and keeping his nose clean. Quietly, without ever making a display of defiance, he did what he could to protect scientists from the ire of the new morality and their stooges in government. When a headstrong young geologist returned from a stint on the exploration of Mars, insisting that the red planet's long-extinct intelligent species had arisen separately from life on Earth, Feingold immediately saw that such a conclusion ran counter to the new morality's teaching that the Martians had been created by God in the Garden of Eden and banished to Mars for their evil ways. He rewrote the young hothead's research report, casting his conclusions as an unproven hypothesis, and banishing his supporting evidence to a thick set of footnotes that nobody but a scientist would bother to read. The geologist never forgave Feingold for editing his paper. But the young researcher wasn't drummed out of his university post. He wasn't forced into community service that would have taken him away from his home and his research for years. He was able to go on with his career. When a naive microbiologist sent in a proposal to study the evolution of the growing resistance to antibiotics that many strains of bacteria had developed, Feingold gently convinced her to drop that dreaded word evolution from her proposal. And so it had gone for more than 2 decades. Go along, get along. Don't make waves. Do what you can. He knew that many of his colleagues detested him and accused him of being a collaborator with the forces of ignorance. Their disdain hurt, but Feingold took solace in the fact that he helped get at least a little real work accomplished. I'm not a Judas goat, he often told himself. I'm a wolf in sheep's clothing. Well, maybe a cocker spaniel. Besides, he sometimes joked to his oldest and most trusted colleagues, I'm Jewish, and from Brooklyn yet. If the new morality gets pissed off at something that some scientist does out in Podunk U, they can always blame it on the New York Jew in charge of NSF.